School CEO Conversations is an Aptigy Media production. We like to have insightful conversations with education's most inspiring and thoughtful leaders. In this episode, Schoolhouse Burning, we talk with Professor Derek W. Black, Ernest F. Hollings Chair in Constitutional Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and author of Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. Here are today's hosts, Michael and Brittany.
We're really excited for today's podcast because today we actually have Professor Derek W. Black, who is an education law professor at the University of South Carolina. And he recently wrote a book called Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. And so we're really excited to dive into his book, but also especially some of the issues that a lot of school districts and school boards are facing right now. So Derek, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, before we jump into the book, which we're really excited about, just to give everybody some context, I actually read Schoolhouse Burning. It was either right before or right after the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. So for me, it was kind of a right about perfect timing to read the book and how public education has informed American democracy. So we do want to dive into that. But before we actually got into some of the substance of the book, I wanted to ask a little bit about your background and kind of how you actually got into the field of education law to begin with. And so could you actually share a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up and kind of what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to the question of how I came to education law is really self-realization in many respects, right? We have our own experiences and we don't reflect on them in the immediacy, but over time we kind of look back and either figure out how everything worked out or we construct our own narratives. And, you know, I grew up and went to a lot of different schools as a young person, you know, had family breakups and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until middle school that I finally came to a school system that I stuck at, and that was Clinton Schools in Clinton, Tennessee. Clinton, Tennessee was the first school district in the South, the first traditionally white school in the South to graduate an African-American student. So it was the first place that Thurgood Marshall went after Brown versus Board. Now, that was before my time, but that little sleepy town had a lot of history. And as I learned more, I reflected back on, oh, yeah, I know that place I used to play pickup basketball at. That's the one-room school that, you know, all the African-American children used to go to just a few hundred yards behind the place where I went to middle school. And so, yeah, I had this general sense of history. But as I also reflected back on myself, I fully appreciated that I wouldn't be here on this podcast with you today. I wouldn't be a professor if it wasn't for the loving arms of school teachers that sort of wrapped themselves around me and didn't let me fail even when I wanted to fail. Even when I tried to undermine myself, I had people who kept me on track. And so I talk about in the book that public education is the intergenerational inheritance that we give to one another, that we pass on, that we've been passing on for 200 years at least here, and that it is the only inheritance that disadvantaged children really receive in America. And so I got mine, and I feel obligated to pass that on to others.
And so when you mention that this inheritance, like public education being the only inheritance that disadvantaged children receive, I guess what impact did public education have on your life specifically?
I think, first of all, going to Clinton High School, which did have this history of school integration and a community that did come together eventually around that issue, was meaningful to me. Just adults who weren't related to me but thought it was their job to make me succeed in life was incredibly important. I mean, I tell a story in the book. I was back at my old high school telling this story recently, and they laughed. I'm not sure why they laughed because I don't know the backstory. But in any event, you know, when I was a sophomore in high school, they, in English class, said, hey, you know, who wants to be in AP English? Here's the form, you know, have your mom and dad fill it out and bring it back in if you want to be considered. Well, when they described the amount of work, Derek Black being who Derek Black was, said, yeah, that doesn't sound interesting to me. I crumpled it up, threw it in the trash can, and it never saw my home. The next year when I showed up and I think, I guess it was first period, and I was in AP English. I was confused, and I literally raised my hand. I said, "Miss Calhoun, I'm not supposed to be here." And she said, "That's okay. We'll talk about it after class." And we never talked about it after class, right? And that is sort of one small sort of piece of my story, because that certainly helped me grow and get a good education. And there's other little examples like that. You know, I talk about making a zero on a math, on an algebra 2 class, because I wasn't sleeping at home and I was making up for that time in algebra in the mornings when we had a, you know, a student teacher, and she, you know, she didn't sort of weigh as heavily on us. But my normal algebra 2 teacher, sensed that something was going on. You know, he and she allowed me to take the test over again. I made 100, and, you know, the rest is history, right? It's those type of things, like real humans, real teachers, real children, you know, trying to move us forward, that made all the difference in my life.
And I was really interested in that aspect of seeing, like, this place of history firsthand and actually going through that. You know, we're based in Little Rock, Arkansas, where obviously there's Central High School, where the Little Rock Nine happened. I mean, just honestly, and our old office was just really a couple blocks away. And that's something that, you know, honestly, we see all the time. And so just kind of curious for you, like, what impact did that have on you, maybe even subconsciously early on, seeing kind of this place where this, you know, integration history happened?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'll say, you know, the Little Rock and Clinton connections are very deep if you look at them in history. Clinton precedes Little Rock. Clinton is actually bombed during desegregation. They'd sort of already integrated for a year, and then it was bombed. The National Guard comes out. So local folks know that story well. Historians know that story well. But most people couldn't put their finger on the map and tell you where Clinton, Tennessee is, or even which side of Tennessee it is. And that's just because we were a small community. But, you know, it had a slightly different effect on me than if I had been in a big community, because when we watched the black and white reel-to-reel footage of our community, of Clinton, Tennessee, and they put the names and the streets up there, like, we knew who the protesters were. We knew that that was such and such his grandfather, right? And so that kind of sent chills down our spine in a way that it might not if you're from a larger geography, that we knew the places, the building, the people. And even now, when we go back, and I didn't realize this until more recently, that there's now a monument up on the hill where I used to play pickup basketball in the one-room African-American school. There's a monument of all the children who walked off the hill. It was, you know, 11 that day. And there's the pictures and the names. And what I did not realize until I went to that monument was that those last names were the same last names of all my classmates, right? And so, again, you know, the small town community really brings it home and personalizes it in a way that a larger system may not.
Yeah. So how did you go from seeing, I guess, feeling that sense of place and the power of sense of place to choosing education law?
So I ended up, I should say, when I was in an undergraduate, I had a religious studies class that met right after another class that was African American studies class. And the professor who taught, you know, the African American studies class, he just is a nice guy. And sometimes we would just chat because he was slow getting out and maybe I was early getting in. I don't know. But, you know, like young people do, I was like, well, he seems like a pretty nice guy. I'll just take his class. And so I took his class the next semester, and it was a class on topics and racism. And so that really sort of got me into the study of African-American studies. That ended up becoming one of my majors at the University of Tennessee. And, of course, you know, that history is always deeply embedded in education and integration. So I got very interested in sort of civil rights issues. I got a little bit of advocacy on campus. And I think, you know, one thing just sort of tumbled into another. You know, when I went to law school, I wanted to do civil rights work. It just so happened that the first place that made me an offer was the Office for Civil Rights at the United States Department of Education. And, you know, it just sort of clicked. And the assignment they gave me that first summer was to write a report on the educational benefits of school diversity. This was before Grutter versus Bollinger had been decided, you know, announcing that that was permissible. So I got a front row seat or working seat to the research that went into school diversity as a compelling interest under the jurisprudence. And I mean, I think this is a testament to like experiences matter, like in the same way that I said teachers matter, like individual teachers doing something for an individual student really changes the course of their life. Well, you know, an experience at the U.S. Department of Education, Office for Civil Rights, you know, had I went to work at HUD, you know, Housing and Urban Development, maybe I would have been a housing attorney and been far less satisfied with that, to be quite frank. But nonetheless, that opportunity, I think, set a path for me.
And so you've worked at the OCR. I know you've actually dealt with civil rights lawsuits pertaining to education in the past. So I was curious, especially for the superintendents listening to this podcast, I want to just give some context. Like, what has been your relationship to public school districts within your like professional career as an attorney?
Yeah, I mean, it has shifted over time, and it shifts because of what the issues are. So I started out as a civil rights lawyer, and my primary job would have been to sue school districts, to be quite frank. Now, I wasn't suing all of them, but, you know, certainly suing some of them. And, you know, school desegregation has waned to a certain extent, and anti-discrimination law is actually much harder to, very hard to win a case, notwithstanding what people on television might say. And what I began transitioning towards at Howard University School of Law, again, my life coming full circle, right, the sort of place where Thurgood Marshall spearheaded, you know, this work back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But at Howard, I began to focus a lot more on school funding, sort of statewide school funding inequity. And that is not a superintendent's fault. That's not a school district's fault. That is a state legislator's fault. I mean, lots of times your racial discrimination, although it can happen at a statewide level and historically has, is more localized quite often, or at least may appear to be more localized. But school funding, state policy, statewide policy, it's district versus the state, or students versus the state. So then I began to position myself, not because I wanted to, that's just the nature of the work, as being, you know, how can I help students and school districts sort of achieve their common goal? And, you know, the state is the impediment quite often on that. And then, you know, over the last decade or so, what we've really had is a war on teachers, you know, a war on public education. And that has called upon me to be a defender of public education writ large, a defender of teachers. And that kind of puts me in a tricky position at times because, you know, some of my maybe former allies or people who perceive that, it's like, well, you're defending all of this discrimination and racism that happens in schools, or you're defending, you know, bad teachers or ineffective teachers. And, you know, I think we really have to separate out like systems issues from sort of like aberrational issues, right? We have systems that are designed to make schools funded unequally. We have systems that are designed to, in my opinion, you know, promote pedagogy that may not be helpful to students or teachers, right? The fact that we may have individual teachers who aren't good, regardless of what system they are in, doesn't mean that it's wrong for me to attack those systems. So what we really have quite often today, and superintendents can really appreciate this, is detractors taking anecdotes as a basis for attacking the system, rather than recognizing the value of that system. They're actually trying to undermine that system. And that is unfortunately a terrible place where we find ourselves right now.
You mean that it's more complicated and it's not a monolith?
Yeah. You know, and even, you know, and look, hey, I throw out all manner of critique for charter schools. But when I remember, I'm always apt to say we can't paint charter schools with a broad brush. It is not the case that all charter schools are bad. There are charter schools that are diverse by design, right? There are charter schools who serve ELL and LGBTQ youth that their home district is not doing a very good job at, right? There are some charter schools that are significantly outperforming their local counterparts. But I've used the word some quite a bit, right, to say that those are sort of examples. I think the problem is the overall system is not designed to produce those some outcomes that I just discussed now. And that quite frankly, is also a position that I've evolved on over time. You know, I early on talked about charters as being an empty vessel that we could make with them what we wanted. And what I've found is that we aren't really making with them what we want, that large institutional actors are making with them something that I think is problematic.
So wanted to move on to the book, Schoolhouse Burning, because again, I know I mentioned Brittany read it as well. So not just, you know, having you on just to talk about this, really do like the book, because you put a lot of the conversations around public education in its historical context. And you talked about kind of some of the assault that's happening on public education right now. And so I was just kind of curious, what did lead you to wanting to write Schoolhouse Burning, which I'm assuming you started kind of before the pandemic and before a lot of people started focusing a lot on education when the COVID pandemic happened?
Yeah, I probably started thinking about that book in 2018 or something like that, working on it, maybe 2019. And the very earliest iteration, I might say, was almost like a fanboy, to be quite honest. I was like, look at all these like grassroots people taking it to the streets and, you know, lifting up the claims that academics like myself, you know, might write about for a decade, but nobody really cares, right? It's like they are making real what I, you know, spend my time thinking about all day. And I was like, you know, I've got to amplify that or be a fanboy, whatever. It's like And so the unfortunate part of that is that my agent told me, like, you know, education policy books don't sell. So if you think you're going to write a book about education policy and like all these, you know, wonky things like that, that's, you know, go back to, you know, NYU Press or Yale or Harvard or something. But, you know, they're not having that at Barnes and Noble. So we worked on it for a while. We sort of thought about it. And one of the points that I came to in my mind over the course of writing the book is that you cannot, well, if you understand the last decade is maybe being a perfect storm, and a perfect storm that combines the underfunding of schools with the attack on teachers, with the calls for private choice, with the radical expansion of vouchers and charters. If you see that, and that descriptively is accurate, right? If you sort of look at those policy forces, it's very difficult to interpret a perfect storm when you stand in the middle of it, you know, and that those policies get, you know, loaded down with the wonky stuff that, you know, finds themselves in state house testimony or policy reports, but like the rest of the public doesn't care about. And even the people waging those battles in state houses and federal level, you know, they're arguing about data, right? Well, is this leading to a better result, or might it leave, or what's the prediction, da 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 da. And I said, look, I say this early in the book, I could write a book about the policy end, the empirical end of these. But I said, I think the only way you get a good handle on these policies is to zoom out and simply ask, what values do they represent? And understanding them as value choices before you even go to the question of empirical results requires a much wider lens. And so that's what sort of forced me to zoom out, to try to go to the beginning of our national commitment to public education and identify the very high-level values that are being pursued across time, sometimes good, well, most of the time good, sometimes bad, and to say, where does this current agenda fit? Does it fit on the better side of history or the worse side of history? And I think that's a bit more objective and reasonable place to approach it from, so that it doesn't become a shouting match about individual ideology. It becomes sort of a collective wisdom question across time. And so that's the book I tried to write. And, you know, I learned a lot in writing it, that there's a lot more to that story than I had ever appreciated until I started writing the book.
Well, I like when you say it's value choices, because a lot of times I feel like we don't necessarily think about that, right? I mean, I know in the book you mentioned that every state constitution has a commitment to public education, free public education for all citizens. There are certain values that led to that decision to put that in the constitution, right? We would not have codified it in what is the supreme law of each state that if it wasn't something that was valued. So I think that's a really interesting way to look at it, is, okay, backing up to the values. And so if we were to do that, I guess, how does that reshape our views of policy or how we talk about policy?
Well, I mean, just to add a little bit of context to what you're asking. So I articulate the nation's founding as being an experiment in democracy, right? That at that moment in time, the world was ruled by kings and queens, right? And the United States had just fought a war to get out from underneath the king. Now, some thought, let's just make George Washington the king. That got shot down, fortunately. So the other option is to turn it over to the people, right? Something that didn't really exist. And when we say turn over the people, we talk about relatively wealthy, elite white men saying, rather than us just run this thing ourselves, we're going to let cobblers and tailors and dock workers vote. Now, you know, of course, women and African Americans were excluded at that time, and even some white men without land. But they're saying, let's turn it over to them. Now, if you're George Soros or Donald Trump of the world at that time, you're going to be a little bit anxious about letting your workers decide your future. And what the founding fathers were quite adamant about was that if we're going to do this thing, we have to make sure that people cast their votes intelligently. And the only way that we can hope to have intelligent vote casting is through education of all the people. And the only way that we can hope to have education of all the people is for the state to take responsibility, not the market, but the state, as a self-preservation of democracy, to make sure that the people who show up to vote are well-educated.
When you say state, do you mean state in like the political sense of like the country, or do you say state in terms of the states?
I mean the country overall, right, as a state, the country state, right? And then that gets sort of brought. Now you have this open question of now who is, at what level of the state should be responsible for this delivery, right? Should it be the United States government? Should it be the individual states? And, you know, I talk about this in the book, you know, the detractors of the right to education say, well, the word education doesn't appear in the federal constitution. States be able to do whatever they want to. You know, my response to that is actually the federal government made a commitment and mandate for public education before we even had a United States constitution. And that was in the Northwest Ordinance. That at least as to the land outside the colonies, right? The other, you know, we had a few states, but for the rest, right, this 30 some odd other that we have, that they would be obligated to carve up into squares the remainder of the land of the United States of America into little towns, and in the center lot of every town would be a public school, and the outlying lots of those towns would be used to generate resources for those schools, right? So that is a plan that predates the United States Constitution. Now, this isn't really in the book. It's more in my other scholarship. There is a commitment to localism, though, right? So we have a federal mandate, but it is the local state or the local entity that is obligated with carrying out, you know, that quote-unquote federal mandate. And so it's been a weird relationship. You know, I don't think they obviously couldn't perceive the complexity of the modern day, but, you know, that is the original relationship established at the nation's founding. To make sure. And so today, right, I said, look, if what we have is calls or sort of an attack on the theory of public education itself, and that's what we have, right? They say, oh, you know, this is the nanny state. These are government schools. They're indoctrinating children. They're depriving people of freedom. You know, they're Looney Tunes on critical race theory, on and on and on. Let's get rid of public education altogether. Now, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you there aren't any flaws in public education. But if we go back to that original founding, the idea is it's only the state. Well, actually, the state must do this to preserve itself, right? Otherwise, we're going to have vast disparities. And also, as James Adams says, very early on, he said it's actually more in the interests of the elites that we have public schools than anything else, right? Because it is the common experience of the highest ranks of society with the lowest ranks of society all being lifted to an equal plane in education that will ensure this democratic project doesn't devolve into pitchforks and chaos.
Why do you think it is that like this connection between education and democracy is not something that we hear a lot about? You know, we hear about schools needing to prepare students for the workforce. We hear about schools needing to like have more technology or, you know, preparing students for college. But I feel like this idea of students as future citizens is something that you really only hear in the context of a civics class. And as we know, civics education is not something that has been, you know, overemphasized, at least in the last couple decades.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things going on, right? I mean, it is true that our businesses generate a lot of taxes. Our large capital holders create a lot of taxes. And so there is this tension. There is this tension about, you know, the accumulation of public resources and the diversion of them to, or what some people would call the diversion, but the sort of spending of those resources on regular people. And you've got sort of, you might say, the capitalists saying, well, if I'm going to spend money on these kids, I want them to come work for me and be able to do my job for me, right? The flip side of that is, well, wait a minute, though. The only reason we even have these things to begin with is for the preservation of democracy. So, you know, it would be foolish for me to suggest that capitalist interests have not been a central part of the expansion of public education as well. It's like, well, if we've got to do this, we being capitalists, then we're going to influence its direction. But the other part of it is that, and some of the people that have reviewed and commented on my book have pointed this out, is that when you read the literature on education and democracy, that it is often puffery. You know, it kind of sounds good, but there isn't a lot of substance behind it. Google, you know, education and democracy, and you'll pull up a lot of books and you read them and they're just kind of like, it's kind of a sales pitch of sorts. What I think sets mine aside is that this isn't a sales pitch. This is actually a historical tradition and commitment that's very deep. Now, you could say, well, but was this just Thomas Jefferson's sales pitch? So what this really is just an old sales pitch. You could make that claim, although I will tell you without boring the readers, there's enough sort of implementation, failures, and successes across time to suggest, no, this isn't just a sales pitch. It was a theory and an idea of the founders that has borne itself out to be true across time.
And that's what I actually really did like about your book, is that you use a lot of like original documents to support this idea from over time, right? I mean, starting, like you mentioned, pre-Constitution, before the United States existed, to all the way to now. I'm thinking about school districts, and I know you mentioned the word indoctrination, and, you know, how people like to throw that word around, which is kind of ridiculous considering, you know, how, I mean, school districts are each individual, you know, school district kind of runs itself. So it's just kind of this whole idea of indoctrinating people is just kind of ridiculous. But it does sound like school districts have a really big opportunity to highlight like this history and highlight where like these values come from. And you talked about, for example, like Northwest Ordinance. I mean, in a lot of states like, you know, Ohio, Nebraska, all this, you can look at the school district and still see like the impacts of the Northwest Ordinance on the school district and the way that, you know, the plots of land are built out. And you can see that there. And so kind of like you were talking about with your own experience in Clinton. So I was kind of curious, I mean, do you feel like schools should be more proactive in promoting this idea of the connection to democracy?
I think they should. But before I even say that, let me just say, you know, because I think people can appreciate this. I remember as a child going to Kings Island theme park in Ohio. And for those of us, you know, from south of the Mason-Dixon line, when you cross over from Kentucky into Ohio or Kentucky into Indiana, Illinois, etc., like the political boundaries are a lot different there. I'm like, what is this? Like everything is square. You know, like where I'm from, there is not a square county in the state of Tennessee. In fact, I don't know if there's a square county in the South anywhere, right? But when you go to Ohio, I mean, there is straight as can be. And that is because the Northwest Ordinance carved up that land and all the rest of it into square little districts and square little towns, with schools being in the middle square of all of it. So, you know, I think this goes actually kind of back to your Clinton question earlier, right? I think giving some context, some feeling, something that you can see and experience, I think really embeds a thought and an idea and experience in teaching more than anything else. So, you know, now I'm outside of my expertise, you know, Brittany's the public school teacher in the group here, not me, but, you know, I am an educator at the higher education level. So, you know, that's a great one. And I think by then telling a story about the Northwest Ordinance or a democracy that sort of really brings it home is important. I mean, I tell you, this just shows how sort of maybe quirky or boring I am, but I love looking at old schoolhouses. Like when I started this book, I spent so much time on the internet, and you don't see any of this in the book, but I spent so much time on the internet just looking at old, I was like, can I find the oldest school building, you know, built, you know, and in this state, in that state, and then it's like, you know, and trying to put together like, well, I knew this city came first, so its high school ought to be older than that one. And it's, you know, I think that now kids maybe not care much about that, but I think the point being finding that avenue. And one of the reasons why looking for those pictures for me was so important was that I really understood that this was the first physical structure that these communities are building on the frontier, right? Like we use words like frontier, like what does that mean? You know, are we sort of describing these sort of vague terms? But then you really look at a picture and go, you know, these 30 people in the plains, and they build this building because the Northwest Ordinance said build it here, right, and input to it. And so I think it is a story that's really worth telling. You know, I have given a few lectures and hope to be doing even more about the post-Civil War period when public education really gets started here in the South. And I think that is a great venue. And the children that I've taught, middle school children and elementary school children I've taught about this, they really latch on to a story about the first schools in their states and the public schools for African Americans in their states, right? So that you're teaching an education story, you're teaching a story about the Constitution, you're teaching a story about race. And, you know, they ask lots of good questions. But aside from just like making things interesting and really coming back to your question, Michael, you know, you said you read this book, you know, right after the insurrection. Well, I was set to deliver a talk on January the 7th for the U.S. Capitol Historical Society.
Oh, wow.
And they wanted me to talk about my book, Education is a Civil Right. Well, of course, the Capitol had been under siege less than 24 hours earlier. So they called me and I thought, well, they're canceling. You know, why would we do this stupid book talk? And they said, well, we'd like you still to do it, but can you do it about the insurrection? And I said, sure, yeah. And as I began to prepare my remarks, what I found was I didn't actually have to change them that much, right? I had to account for what had happened on that day. But the key question that I was trying to answer was, what is the commitment of the rule of law of individuals who would engage in that type of insurrection? What type of anti-citizenship values do they represent? And what's all the stuff that our schools are supposed to be doing that's different than that? And, you know, I don't think our schools alone could stop January 7th. That would be preposterous. But do they play a huge role in shaping the culture, in shaping the values, in shaping our sense of the rule of law? Yes, they do. You know, there's a famous Goss v. Lopez, which probably a lot of superintendents know that case name. Goss v. Lopez is the case in which the Supreme Court says that anytime, you know, you suspend or expel a student, they have to get due process. Oh, crap. Now we got to have hearings and appeals and all of this. But there's this line in there where the Supreme Court says the public schools are the first experience that individuals have with government. And if what we have is a suspension and expulsion, which is the first contested experience with government that isn't perceived as being fair, then you have forever negatively shaped and bent a child towards having a negative, right, sort of perception of its relationship to the state. I mean, that's quite insightful point to make about school discipline, right? And we can take this to everything else that a school does as well.
Yeah, so when you were talking about, you know, this relationship between democracy and school, so I was thinking about my own experience. So I've been a senior teacher teaching rhetoric before, and I have taken that charge of preparing students for citizenship very, very seriously, including holding voter registration drives where we registered every kid in the senior class who was eligible to vote. And I remember, like, in retrospect, telling people about this in the community, and I would get one of two responses. I would get, oh, that's amazing. Or I would get a response of, wow, that terrifies me. And I feel that like that second response says something about some sort of distrust that has developed for schools. And, you know, in thinking about the legitimacy of public education, which is a major thesis of your book, like, where does that distrust come from? And I feel like it, you know, how does it play a role in like what is going on now?
There certainly are individuals who are fomenting that distrust, right? So let's just talk about them first as a subset of the problem, right? I talk about this in the book that, you know, the Koch brothers and DeVosses of the world had been spending enormous amounts of money to shrink the footprint of government. Now, when you're talking about shrinking the footprint of government at the federal level, you're talking about Social Security, Medicare, and the military. Most people don't, you know, high-income taxpayers, they like, you know, guns and war to protect our stuff. So, you know, so we're really talking about, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but we're talking about shrinking Medicare, shrinking Social Security. Right? So we've seen all that. We saw the Obamacare fights and all that. When you come to the state and local level, right, the number one line item ticket is public schools. So if you're anti-tax, if you're anti-big government, then you're anti-public education because that is government at the state and local level, right? All that's meaningfully left over other than that is like the fire and the police, neither of which are actually all that consuming in the grand scope of things. And right, you would sort of see those as basic necessities. So, you know, you've just got this libertarian notion that we ought to be paying fewer taxes and public schools are part of the problem. So that's where, and so what they're doing is sort of attacking the public education project using different rhetoric, different tactics, but I see it as primarily being how can we shrink government's footprint. You know, you've got this other group that is, you know, just sort of the evolving tensions around religion as religion plays a smaller place in society or at least public spaces across time, this sort of feeling that that's the public school's fault. And not only are public schools exiting from the conversation of religion, they believe that they're being anti-religious at school. And so, you know, you've got that strain going in there as well. And then you've got the other problem, which I am quite blunt about as a civil rights advocate throughout my career, which is we have public school systems in this country that for never one day in the history of this nation have ever fully served those communities. That those communities are skeptical for good reason of the state and its failure to ever live up to it. So you kind of have at least three, and there's probably a fourth and a fifth, but it's sort of three different constituencies here, significant constituencies, that are posing real challenges to the public education project.
And so I want to touch on that just a little bit about these, you know, these constituencies, because I know you didn't talk in the book about like this commitment to public education, universal public education, but you also do acknowledge how America has not lived up to that commitment and how there have been failings. And obviously you've seen this firsthand as you've brought suits against school districts that have not been upholding that. So I was curious though, like when you're looking at the public right now, or you're looking at public opinion right now, there seems to be kind of almost two extremes of one end of, you know, America has only been great and has never done anything wrong. And on the other end is that everything America's done is fraught with problems and needs to kind of be taken out. But it sounds like from, you know, with the book that when it comes to public education, yes, there are failures, but overarching, there has been this like overall commitment. And so I was wondering, I mean, have we lost like some of this nuance when it comes to, I mean, not just obviously politics, but specifically when it comes to public education?
Oh, I mean, every day that the TV and internet continue to exist, we lose a little bit of nuance. You know, we maybe add a little bit as well, but we lose it. But to answer your question, when what I might call the dueling frameworks of the 1619 Project and President Trump's 1776 Commission began, you know, there's a reality that I say exists in the middle, which is maybe more about me than reality. But I think there is a reality, or there is a perception, right? I mean, I think when you, and I think you framed it, or I think I heard you say it rightly, Michael, which is, you know, there's a perception about history. We might say that's the 1776 perception, and then there's a 1619. I hesitate to put the word perception on it, but sort of perception. But both of them are talking about the same underlying facts, quite often, but interpreting them with different meaning or sort of attributing different meaning to them. So without picking sides or saying one is right or one is wrong, I will tell you that the meaning that I interpret that I think exists in the middle, which is America begins as an incredibly ambitious and wonderful idea. It has at no point in its history ever achieved any of those ideas. It has gone backwards at points on those ideas. But the story of America that I tell in this book, and I think the one that we need to tell in our schools, is an America with a great idea that's been forever reaching for it, right? And by reaching, that may often mean oppressed people reaching for the idea of America and oppressors trying to stop them. But, you know, there's what I find just an incredible passage by Abraham Lincoln and that I put in my book that I think sums this up. He said, when the founders wrote that all men are created equal, they knew very well that at that moment, men and women were in chains. They knew at that very moment that there wasn't going to be freedom anytime in the close future in America. But what Lincoln does in trying to rearticulate the nation and says is that they wrote those words down not because they were true at that moment, but because at some point in the distant future, right, that we could reach back on those ideas and insist based upon the wisdom of an old idea that schools should not just be for white people or white men, that they should be for all and they shouldn't be segregated. We go on and on and on. And that's the way, rightly or wrongly, I try to sort of live out my career is to say, no, you know, these old guys weren't perfect. We all know they were flawed, but they really did have some great ideas. And I say, so great of an idea that they themselves were not willing to live up to it. All right. And we can say the same things with our state education clauses. Fantastic ideas that call upon the state to do more than it's ever done in its history. And we're on the project to doing that. And so I tell the book as being American democracy and sort of reaching for it, as we say, as we often talk about, the education walks right beside that, is that these American ideas find themselves in public schools and we reach for them. And then we have people punch us in the face and move us back and we reach for them again, but we're always reaching. And I think that's the way that I see it. That's the way I try to tell it.
And so I feel like this is a good time to transition into what a lot of superintendents are probably either facing themselves or have heard about. And you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but this community members that have been really opposed to the idea of, for example, critical race theory, that's been thrown around a lot. It's been talked about on Tucker Carlson. I think NPR said something like, you know, 13,000 times over the last month or 1,300 times. I mean, so this is obviously coming out a lot. It's now we're even seeing school boards are having protests at them. There have been people challenging school boards in elections. And then NBC News just recently came out with a report that even groups like the Heritage Foundation and ALEC have been actually supporting financially as well as propping up and encouraging a lot of these anti-CRT movements that are targeting specifically school boards. And so wanted to transition a little bit. How does this like anti-CRT movement as well as some of these conservative actors propping this up, how does that fit into this like long-term trajectory that you've written about in the book?
Well, let me first say that I'm sure a lot of superintendents out there scratch their heads when they hear this stuff because, first, they're not really sure what critical race theory is, and second, whatever it is, they didn't know their schools were teaching it, and third, if they were teaching it, you know, they might ask them why they weren't teaching the state standardized, you know, curriculum or something like that because they've got tests coming up. So, you know, yeah, I mean, and the other thing here, which superintendents I think will all agree with me, is there's probably nothing that a superintendent hates more than controversy, right? Like you just don't want it. Right. It's just like keep things quiet, keep the trains running, you know, let's make the bells ring on time, make sure everyone has food and that they're administered tests, don't have time for it, don't want the phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think people who believe that our schools are indoctrinating children, they haven't been in school in a long time. I mean, there's certainly norms that are taught about civics and, you know, things that Brittany was raising earlier. And you know what? I'm all for indoctrinating kids in the rule of law. Sorry. You know, I'm all for indoctrinating them on their need to write to vote and participate. But, you know, we get beyond that. You know, we may put facts. We put facts in front of children, and they react to them. But we're not indoctrinating them. Don't have time for it. You know, schools don't want to be sued. So, you know, what's going on here? You know, are there some schools that have maybe, you know, gone further than that? Sure. But, you know, aberrational at best. And if they're doing it, I almost guarantee you they're not doing it in schools where there's a lot of people who disagree with them. You know,
right.
They're doing it where it's like, you know, kumbaya and everybody's singing the same song or something like that. So, but I think this is coming from a very dangerous place in my mind, because if we look at that history, that I talk about in the book, what we see is that public education as an institution is the most bipartisan public project that we have. Right. You look at local school boards, right? The superintendents know, unless there's some aberration out there, everywhere I've lived, they're nonpartisan. You actually don't even put an R or a D next to your name when you run for school board, right? And we have various other actors, you know, at the state school board or at the state superintendent that we try. There's lots of different methods, but we try as best to insulate them from the political process. Because the idea is, it's kind of like you've got a job to do and it's not a political one. At least it's not political beyond the idea of making good citizens and making good workers. But beyond that, you know, this isn't political. And, you know, you'd look at election returns. Historically, political opinions about public education haven't diverged that much between political party. There was a study in the South. There was only like 4 or 5 years ago, I talk about this in the book, no more than 3 or 4 percentage points separating Democrats from Republicans on questions of equal school funding, adequate school funding, do we need to do more for teachers, right? Everyone is kind of on the same page when it comes to education. No Child Left Behind, like it or hate it, 85% of Congress, both parties vote for it. Every Student Succeeds Act, like it or not, 85%, right? This is just what America does, supports public schools. Theoretically, whatever that means, support your schools. What's dangerous, it seems to me, about this critical race theory conversation is that it is trying to politicize the public education project, to divide people and their commitment to public education based upon ideology that really has nothing to do with the public education at all, or at least very little to do with it. And to have people, you know, Brittany asked about, you know, where is this sort of school group coming from? Well, this measure, well, first of all, my understanding that these folks are pushing this issue, not because they actually want to change what's taught at schools, not because they're worried about what's being taught at schools, but because they want to rack up more wins in the midterm elections and retake the United States House of Representatives, which in large part has nothing to do whatsoever with what's taught on a day-to-day basis in schools. But the side effect of such a project, the drawing of lines, the drawing of swords and sides, is to create and expand that anti-public education group on what is either making a mountain out of a molehill or a bold-faced lie, one or the other. But either way, right, it divides people in a very problematic way. And that scares me because, you know, in 2018, 2019, I saw people, right, in the reddest of red states, right? It starts in West Virginia, 75% vote for Trump. The red for Ed, that's where it starts. And then it goes to, you know, Kentucky, which I think he was 65 or so percent there. It goes to Oklahoma. It goes to Arizona, right? It goes to Trump country and says, we want more for our schools and our students. And these are, you know, here in South Carolina, it was a Trump voter who led the sort of demand of our U.S. senators to know, why is it that you think you should vote for Betsy DeVos to be Secretary of Education, right? She organized 5,000 people for a town hall, right? Trump voters. And that made me feel warm inside for public education. And this current situation is moving in the exact opposite direction. And that scares me. I was talking to a colleague yesterday. I hold out hope that regular people that aren't sort of on the polarized sides of this, that sort of big fat middle, hopefully realize that this is a bunch of nonsense and they're not really paying that much attention. It's like, yeah, it's all over the media, but Hopefully everyone else is just at the beach, you know?
Yeah. Well, and when we're looking at like parents, I mean, I imagine for a lot of these families, a lot of these parents, like for them, it is a genuine concern about things being taught, right? If, you know, especially a lot of them starting out. But like you were saying, this is something that there is frankly something much more nefarious behind the scenes that's really pushing. And in fact, Steve Bannon in his podcast, unfortunately, I had to listen to it from a couple weeks ago. He had a quote in there saying that the path to save the nation is very simple. It's going to go through the school boards. And he actually even specifically mentions the Tea Party and how that was the largest wave of change in the House of Representatives since like FDR. And talking about how this is the next move. And so it really does seem like this is about putting more people into Congress to be able to do what they want in Congress, not about what's actually happening in the schools, not about what's actually being taught in the classroom.
Let's hope that they don't prove to be prescient on that. But the one thing, though, that is true across time that this situates itself in is that people who cannot have their way in the real world have a tendency to try to have their way in the microcosm of schools, right? You don't like the way society's morals are going. Well, rather than trying to convince your friends or your family or your neighbors or your elected officials to see things your way, you try to shove it down some kid's throat or make life hell for the superintendent and the teachers. Maybe you can get your way there. It's like a lot easier actually sometimes to push around teachers and superintendents than it is.
Because like you mentioned, they don't want controversy.
They don't want you make a perfect point that I wasn't making. They don't want controversy. So if I just go down there and raise a big stink, maybe I'll get my way, right? And so this has played out across time. And super sensitivity, right? Oh, no, they weren't having a debate in class. They were indoctrinating my child, right? That type of thing. And so, you know, we've seen this across, we see this with issues of communism way back. You know, we see this issue with the Vietnam War. We see this issue with religion, you know, but we've seen this across time. And so I do think, you know, you have the big actors that you referenced, Michael, trying to achieve other objectives. But then, you know, we do have these other people that are worried about the direction of culture, and they're very susceptible to being scared and taking that out on their local schools.
Well, I think that that's a really good point because, and obviously we've talked to other superintendents about like media literacy and things like that. I know that's one topic that a lot of superintendents out there have really started to focus on, especially, you know, lately. But what I thought was really interesting was when you're talking about, you know, being skeptical of even like progressive policies, because I think if you were, you know, from outer space and dropped into America right now, you would on the surface think, oh, wow, well, I guess Democrats are all pro public ed and conservatives are all against public ed. But I mean, if you go back to, you know, the Obama era, right, it was Arne Duncan who was the one really pushing charter schools and really pushing school choice. And so it is something where it seems like we need to really question and make sure that we're not just, you know, as public ed advocates, just kind of being fanboys of one group or the other, because at some point it seems like they're probably going to work against public ed too.
You're right. Yeah. But bad ideas come from both sides of the aisle. I sometimes wonder that whether some of my friends have been a little bit hesitant to fully embrace or publicly embrace my book because of the harshness with which it deals with Arne Duncan and President Obama early on. And to be clear, I was a member of the Obama-Biden transition team, so I am not, would have been happy to take an appointment, you know, with them. But that doesn't mean that everything, you know, Arne Duncan did was anywhere close to being right. So yeah, I think we have to be critical and thoughtful, and so often we're not. Now, I will say this, so that people don't think I'm a curmudgeon. So after tussling with this in my mind for a couple of weeks and feeling bad that I had, or disloyal or whatever it was, that I had some critiques of the way that advocates on my side of the quote-unquote fence were dealing with things, I said to, I think it was my wife and son that I was walking with at the time, I said, you know what? Academics have time for nuance. You know, staffers have time to construct policies that make sense. And you know what? those ideas and those policies never see the light of day. Really, the only way that the world ever changes is through blunt hammers and blunt force. And so maybe, you know, maybe these young people, maybe these advocates, maybe they're just actually are smarter than me on this. And they say, look, Derek, you're right, like as a matter of policy and thinking and teaching. But what we teach in school, the way we treat people in society will never change if we're waiting on everyone to listen to nuanced, thoughtful people like yourself. We need blunt hammers to change the system. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me that that's a reasonable position to take.
And thinking about these blunt hammers and in thinking about like what's happening in school boards right now, like what advice would you have for a superintendent trying to navigate protests at their school board and navigate questions about CRT? How can they get through this?
Well, I mean, I think they have to unfortunately carve out some time in their calendars. And I say this, and I said this before we had the CRT stuff. I wrote a kind of a, you know, I didn't call it an open letter to Miguel Cardona, but it was sort of what he ought to set his goals with. And I think it's relationship building. You know, I say in at the end of the book that we need to be willing to have uncomfortable conversations. And not that we're going to change our policies on how we treat LGBTQ youth, not that we're going to change our policies on what we're teaching, assuming that what we're teaching is correct. Not that we're going to change any of that, but that, you know, we understand and appreciate that that people have anxieties and have different opinions, and to bring them in to the schoolhouse for school townhouse talks, individual meetings, whatever it is, so that we as a community deal with this. Now, if what we have are outsiders, you know, Washington, D.C., outsiders trying to interfere with our family or our community, I think it's appropriate to shut those people out. But within our school community, we need to have conversations. And maybe we leave that meeting in just as much disagreement as we were before we entered the door. But if we understand one another a little bit better, if we respect each other a little bit more when we leave that room, hopefully we can agree to disagree about some stuff, or at least give each other the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, going back to the points about how I succeeded or didn't succeed and things that I did wrong, I had people that were willing to give me the benefit of the doubt, maybe when I didn't deserve it. And that made all the difference in the world in my life. I think that makes all the difference in the way that schools function.
Well, I did want to just maybe touch on some big ideas here. And because obviously in the book, you take a pretty long-term look at the view of public education as well as its impact on democracy specifically. And so I think you even mentioned this a little bit in the book about how your understandings of American democracy have changed and how evolved. I think you even mentioned how you used to think it was impenetrable and it could never go away. And now maybe it's changed a little bit. And so I was wondering, from your perspective with being an education law scholar, how has your understanding of American democracy and whether or not the experiment is working, how has that evolved and changed over time?
Well, on one level, we've seen far worse than this, right? We saw the creation of a system of slavery under the umbrella of democracy. We saw the removal of a system of slavery under the umbrella of democracy, and then the reimplantation and removal of Jim Crow, right? And so I think this pales in comparison to that. And we certainly saw, you know, as I mentioned earlier, what became my middle school was bombed to prevent, you know, 11 African-American children from staying there. So, yes, school board elections, you know, to win a midterm election are kind of small potatoes in that respect. But when I watched January 7th unfold on TV, maybe it's just because I'm alive now, but it struck me as different than anything in modern experience. And by modern, I kind of mean 20th, 21st century stuff, at least on the home front, right? And this is, as a lawyer, the reason why I say that is that, you know, when I saw people waving flags on the Capitol steps, it looked like to me an occupying force, right? It looked like a hill that had been taken and Vietnam or a building that had been taken in Vietnam or in Russia. And that is not something that I could have ever imagined could happen in America. And you know, maybe you just sort of write it up to like underestimating, you know, the other side, being too comfortable in our modern world. You know, the sun has always come up, and so it'll come up tomorrow. Democracy has always survived, it'll survive tomorrow. And so you get a little bit too relaxed, because there's always been, you know, we had, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing, right, which is more egregious in some respect, right? It took human life. So I don't know. You know, it's so emotional and raw for all of us. It was the first vision I ever had of a force occupying America, an un-American force occupying the seat of power. And that, I think, it just reminds us. I don't think it changed it. It reminds us as to how fragile democracy is, number one, that there's always resistance to it, and number two, the important, back-breaking, day-to-day work that we must do and will always need to do for as long as humans exist and we have a place called America. It's the work that we will day-to-day have to do to reinforce our democracy. We are not genetically, biologically hardwired to see the greater good. You know, humans are biologically hardwired to eat, you know, the food that they need right now, and the smarter ones to kind of save a little bit until tomorrow, right? To keep off invaders and that sort of thing. And so, and that's, you know, to go back to John Adams, I guess I've got him four or five times in this. He said the project is to see the common good, right? What is the thing that benefits us all? And that's not something that we're hardwired to do. And public schools help us do that.
So just to wrap up, for the superintendents out there that are listening, I mean, did you have any advice or any words for them that you'd want to share?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that as they find themselves in these incredibly tricky situations around false claims of critical race theory and harboring, you know, ineffective teachers and all this type of stuff, that I think put your best foot forward, you know, and by that I mean, let's talk about the values that I think we do all hold common. It sounds easy, but let's focus more on what brings us together than what separates us. And I think we take for granted, right, until we see, you know, a January 7th, what brings us together, and to just lead with that. Because I think that, you know, regardless of the complaints that may show up on your doorstep, you know, the public survey data shows that there's a very deep well of support for public education. There's a very deep well of support for public school teachers, that it is the experience, the singular experience that 90% of America has shared together. And it is part of our roots. And to just try to bring us together around those, there's tough conversations we can't run from. But, you know, I think emphasizing what brings us together is important. And as a matter of stating those values, I think, again, it helps build that trust that, you know what, we may disagree on some things, but we all are trying to do the same thing at the large scale level.
Thank you so much, Derek. Really do appreciate you being on today.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this School CEO Conversation. You can follow Professor Black on Twitter at Derek W. Black and find links to his works, including Schoolhouse Burning, in the show notes. Subscribe to School CEO at schoolceo.com for more advice, stories, and strategies for leading your schools. School CEO is brought to you by Aptigee.